Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Amity.
And I'm Laura. Let's get started.
And of course, we have our, what do we want to call you, Nan? Our expert
friend.
Our expert friend, our lovely friend who is also an expert in all things Jane Austen. And anyway, we're very blessed to have her along for the ride.
Aficionado is better.
That's the word that I was looking for. Yes, I love it. Okay. So just a quick recap of where we ended last time. So Mr. Collins was there at Longbourn with the Bennet family, actively pursuing a wife. He was basically turned down by Lizzie, and so he goes after Charlotte Lucas instead, secures an engagement with her. And also, there was the Netherfield Ball during that time, a pretty short time after the Netherfield Ball. Bingley, Miss Bingley, Mr. and Mrs. Hurst, and Mr. Darcy all just leave. And the only communication that Jane has is a letter from Miss Bingley saying they're in London and they're probably not going to come back. Mrs. Bennet is just in hysterics going, Mr. Bennet, you're going to die and Mr. Collins is going to kick us out of the house. And then where are we going to be? And Mr. Bennet, he's just so funny and sarcastic and snarky. And he's just like, well, let's think about happier things. Let's think that maybe you're going to die first. That leads us right into this next section, which we'll be covering, which will be chapters 24 to 33.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I have these recurring dreams where my husband like disappears out of nowhere. He just like leaves. He won't answer my phone calls. He won't ever like this. Anyways, it just kind of sounded like my recurring dream that I have. I have it like once a year, whatever. I'm like, where did you go? And why aren't you answering my phone calls? And that's like my biggest nightmare, I guess. To think the person you're dating.
The 19th century version of ghosting is to get this letter that's like, we're pretty much here for the season. That's it.
Yeah.
The last text you get from the man you think you might be in love with, right?
Yeah. Like no warning. You just left. Anyways, yeah. My biggest nightmare.
And hope was over, entirely over. It's one of the very first lines in our new section.
In chapter 24, Caroline has written back and then they find out that the Bingleys are going to be gone for a long while and may not be coming back. And everybody is really enjoying Miss Darcy, Darcy's younger sister, Georgiana. And like, I love how the letter is like going on and on about how wonderful she is and how like rub it in, rub salt in the wound that we've disappeared and we're with her and she's just great.
They want Bingley to marry Miss Darcy.
Yes. Instead of Jane.
And then if that happens, then it might mean that Miss Bingley is more likely to get Mr. Darcy.
Right.
And they refer to her brother as an inmate of Mr. Darcy's house. So it sounds like they're staying at Darcy's house in the city, but I love how she refers to him as an inmate. He's locked up.
You know, I think I read that word as intimate. I totally misread that word. That's really funny. It's especially distressing because Mrs. Bennet keeps going on and on and on about how Bingley has just disappeared and he's gone. And now what are we going to do? And I can't imagine as a female that's worried about it. And then your mom's keeps bringing it up and won't let it go. So then we have this conversation between Jane and Elizabeth. Jane, of course, wants to give the benefit of the doubt and avoid blaming anyone. Well, Elizabeth responds with, there are few people whom I really love and still fewer of whom I think well. The more I see of the world, the more I am dissatisfied with it. And every day confirms my belief of the inconsistency of all human characters and of the little dependence that can be placed on the appearance of either merit or sense. And then she goes on to say, I've met with two instances lately. One I will not mention, and the other is Charlotte's marriage. It is unaccountable in every view. I love it. So Jane is just like this perfect human that is like, it reminds me of the modern day like thought work. There has to be a reason, you know, don't put blame on anybody. We can figure it out. That's just kind of how she is. And I read somewhere that here Elizabeth is being uncharacteristically pessimistic. Do you guys agree with that?
There's a line we're going to read later on in this section. And it does say essentially to the effect is that Lizzie's not built for ill humor. And that her good humor pretty quickly returns after these instances. I think she's trying to get Jane to feel more. It's like sometimes if you have that friend that's like really, really stoic And you want him to say, no, it's okay to say things are bad. It's okay for you to feel bad. It's okay for you to be angry about the situation. And I feel like in some ways, Lizzie is playing a little bit of a foil here to Jane's sunny optimism, because I think she's trying to help Jane feel her feelings. Jane does not admit to for a long time. And I do feel like in some ways, she's almost like goading Jane into trying to say something, but it doesn't work. Jane has a little bit more of a meltdown later, but I think in some ways they aren't quite the Sense and Sensibility sisters, but Lizzie's more passionate than Jane is for sure. Yeah, I just think she's trying to help her sister feel her feelings that she's not admitting to.
That would make sense that she would be more pessimistic than normal because she's trying to get her sister to admit something. Jane then gives the reasons why Charlotte and Mr. Collins might be a good match. And Elizabeth argues that Mr. Collins is a conceited, pompous, narrow-minded, silly man. And anyone who agrees to marry him cannot have a proper way of thinking. She must be out of her mind.
What do you really think, Lizzie?
Lay it all down.
I know. I love it.
So Jane tells Elizabeth that Mr. Bingley hasn't actually hurt her and doesn't even want to believe that Caroline has ulterior motives here, even though she admits that Miss Bingley wants Mr. Bingley to marry Miss Darcy. Elizabeth believes that it is disgusting that Bingley is so weak that his sister and his friend could convince him to leave somebody that he's falling for and who he thinks he should be with. Jane decides that she wants to take everything, I love this, in quote, the best light, in the light in which it may be understood. So she just wants to look at everything with, I guess, with like rose-colored glasses. But then they decide they're going to stop mentioning Mr. Bingley's name. It might be best if we just don't bring him up.
At one point, they call him that person, like in italics. Like he who must not be named, he's a Voldemort. That,
yeah. I do love that because I feel like it's so relatable for especially like teenage girls, just girls in general to be like, yeah, we don't even say his name. This is our little revenge.
And then after this one name. Event, they've generalized it to all men. Women think admiration means more than it does. Like just because that guy thought you were hot, that doesn't mean he's in love with you. Right. And girls still do this. And then they're like, well, who's to blame for that? Is it the men or is it the women? And they kind of like talk about that. And the conclusion is, well, if the boys are doing it by design, then it's just cruel. But if it's by accident, then maybe the girls need to be more careful. Right. But I love how they analyze, they dissect every part of this to death because they're girls. And this is
that's what we do.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
One of my daughters is like starting to kind of talk to a boy. She's never talked to a boy before like this. And like, he was supposed to come into work yesterday and she's like, well, he forgot. And I'm like, oh, a girl would never forget. I just thought that was funny.
To come to work?
No, he forgot to come see her at work.
Oh, he forgot to
like, see. But like if a girl like with her, she's thinking about it so much, she would never forget. Yeah. Like that would be all she's thinking about that day. Anyways, just kind of funny.
Yeah, I read a whole thing once about like, it was just a funny, like it was an exchange between a man and a woman, one sentence each. And then what happens next is the woman has analyzed every part of that sentence until she's ready to walk out of the relationship. And then it's like what the guy is thinking about is, I think my car needs an oil change.
I think I've seen that same thing. And it's like, you know. Yeah.
Got right.
Okay. So Mrs. Bennet just kind of tells herself, so she doesn't have to worry, I guess, that he's going to come back in the summer. It'll be fine. I love that Mr. Bennet here, how sarcastic he is when he encourages. Now, I had to read this a few times because I was really confused about the dialogue here, but then I think I got it. So Mr. Bennet sarcastically encourages Lizzie to pursue Wickham so that then he can break her heart.
This is one of my favorite exchanges from Mr. Bennet.
So funny. And Elizabeth tells them that they can't all expect to have Jane's good fortune, to which he says, true, but it is a comfort to think that whatever of the kind may befall you, you have an affectionate mother who will always make the most of it.
Well, on the line right before that, next to being married, a girl likes to be crossed in love a little now and then. It's something to think of, and it gives her a sort of distinction among her companions. I know. Because, right, the girl that's just been jilted is the one that gets all the attention.
All the attention. Yeah, attention. Absolutely.
I had a bad breakup once, and that line helps me through it. Like, now I've been crossed in love, and I know a few things, and it gives me distinction among our
That's a good one to quote, like, have that out, right, for those situations.
And then a little further down, he's like, here are officers enough in Meryton to disappoint all the young ladies in the country. So look, everybody gets to be crossed broken in love. Heart. And he says, let Wickham be your man. He is a pleasant fellow and would jilt you creditably.
Yeah, that's no, a foreshadowing, like, Laura.
Well, I kind of know more than I need to know now because my accident with the video last night. I was like, no, stop talking. Yeah, that took me a while to get. But yeah, he's like, you should go after Wickham because then he can break your heart. So after that, Wickham visits occasionally, which kind of helps with the mood in the house because of what Bingley's done. They're kind of, anyways, it kind of helps with that situation. And everybody has a sour taste in their mouth for Darcy, except, of course, for Jane, who, quote, always pleaded for allowances and urged the possibility of mistakes. So she likes everybody. Okay, and then in chapter 25.
Quick thing there, Laura, I think is interesting, as we're going to see with Wickham too, is, and this is something that's very seldom portrayed in the film versions, Wickham doesn't get a whole lot of airtime, especially in the like most recent one, the Keira Knightley. They got a really good looking actor for it and they gave him about three lines. Like, he's just a face. Yeah. And I think some of it is because Austen was not interested in writing lines for Wickham and Lizzie. She alludes to this kind of like attraction between them and that he's coming around to the house a lot. He's a frequent visitor, but we get almost no consistent, like not the pages and dialogue that we get between her and Darcy on a regular basis. And I think it's because that's not the story Austen is interested in telling. And maybe Wickham's dialogue is just not nearly as interesting as what Darcy has to say. And I think this is why Wickham, even though he is getting to be like a major player in their lives, he doesn't seem like he's that big of a deal in the movies because they have no source material to pull from to give Wickham really, really great lines like they have for Darcy, because Wickham just doesn't. I mean, the biggest speech we get from him is when he's bad mouthing Darcy. He's agreeable without being clever. And Darcy is disagreeable, but very clever.
Yeah. At the same time, though, we do find just in these few lines that it says his claims on Mr. Darcy and all that he had suffered from him was now openly acknowledged and publicly canvassed. And that's why everybody doesn't like Mr. Darcy. So he is a big character. Like you say, he is kind of more behind the scenes, but he is an influencer there in that area. Like, everybody has believed what he says about Mr. Darcy.
And it aligns about it now that Darcy's not in the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
He was trying to keep it a little quieter when Darcy was still around. But now that Darcy's left the neighborhood, he'll badmouth Darcy to anybody who will sit still.
To anybody. Yes, absolutely. And I was just thinking about that. And I was like, it's very much an influencer tactic today, isn't it? It's like anybody that has a platform will come out and talk about something as if they have credibility about it. And anybody who follows them will believe it without questioning it.
Yeah, Wickham needs a background check.
He totally needs a background check. He needs Snopes. He needs like somebody to go like fact checkers.
Yeah, he's faking it for sure.
He is for sure. But so many people take the first perspective they get on something, and that is their foundation. And everything else, they'll be like, oh, this is truth. Anything else I hear about it cannot be truth because this is what I heard first. You know what I'm saying? Again, like I said, with influencers today, it's very, very frustrating. I had a friend who's about 23. Maybe I told you guys about this before. It was just so kind of mind-boggling to me. She had heard from a big influencer on TikTok that the Titanic sinking was a conspiracy and it did not sink. It was all an insurance claim fraud. And she was like, I can't believe you think it was real. I was like, I don't even know where to start with you. Like, I, you know, because and you're basing this on.
Like, the influencer is also packaged beautifully. These influencers have followings. They are beautiful people. Like, they are very, and they have a very carefully cultivated, like, persona online. And it's like Wickham, like, it's all window dressing. It's just he looks like. He looks trustworthy, therefore he is. And that is such a caution.
It is. And when people are also like well-spoken and they say a lot, then people are more inclined to believe them, I think, because they sound credible, even like spewing complete garbage and stuff that has been disproven over and over again. But heck with research and facts and books and all the actual evidence. A TikToker said it must be true. So there it is.
He reminds me of
Sergeant Troy in Far From the Madding Crowd.
Yes, I was thinking just the same thing. He totally is Sergeant Troy.
Yes, and how she's just like, I mean, he was beautiful and, you know, he walks in and what he was saying about Darcy fit her narrative that she already had for Darcy. And so she just sucked right in.
She can't see anything except through the lens of what she already believes. It's self-fulfilling prophecy, but there's a better psychology term for it. Confirmation bias.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Is that she's biased towards him and now everything she sees or hears confirms that. And that's why when we get towards the center of the book and see like a massive paradigm shift on her part, she has to completely rewire her way of thinking about the world.
Okay, so Mr. Collins leaves. Mrs. Bennet's brother and wife, Mr. and Mrs. Gardner, come for Christmas. Jane and Elizabeth love Mrs. Gardner and they visit her often. She reminds me, and I was going to ask you guys this, do you have anybody in your life that was like Mrs. Gardner where, you know, their mom wasn't really helpful, but like another adult in your life when you were growing up that you could go to with questions that maybe or advice that you couldn't ask your parents?
Well, I think that can sometimes be like a mentoring type woman that is maybe, I had one aunt that was quite a bit younger and I don't know that I so much like looked to her for advice. I sometimes wish I had a little more, but I just adored her. And I think Mrs. Gardner, if you look at it, so like her husband is quite a bit older than she is because the Gardners still have quite young kids. And you don't get she is especially close to the older two girls. You don't get the impression that like she's old enough to be their mom. So I think she's kind of a young aunt. I mean, even their own mom, I know we think of Mrs. Bennet as being older. She's probably 40, like tops. So Mrs. Gardner is very likely in her like late 20s, maybe 30s. She might only be 7 or 8 years older than the girls. And so they view her, I think, in some ways as almost like, yeah, like an older sister mentor type.
I think my daughters think of my sisters like that. Like they would go to my sisters about stuff that maybe they didn't feel comfortable talking to me, or they don't like, not that they're not comfortable, but they don't want to hear what I'm going to say because my sisters might give them a different answer.
And there's going to be less judgment. Quite frankly, parents are so invested in their kids. As much as you try not to like react with like when your kids tell you something, you know, you have to practice so hard to school your face that you don't freak out on them when they tell you stuff. I get this a lot in school teaching. I will have kids who are like, you're like my school mom, right? But I think it's because they feel like they can confide in me about things that they don't feel like they can tell their parents. I want them to keep secrets from their parents. Usually what I counsel them to is like, have you found a way to talk to your mom about this? Like, I don't encourage kids to keep secrets from their parents in any way. But sometimes until they're ready to talk to their parents, having somebody they can kind of run it by first is a huge help.
Absolutely. Yeah, I always think I want there to be other adults in my kids' life that they feel like they can go and talk to and that will give them solid advice and that will hopefully turn them back to me. I just think kids need lots of good adults in their life, not mm-hmm. just their parents, because we don't have all the answers. There's just no way. And even if we did, our kids wouldn't listen to half of them anyway. So like,
well, I think about like Mrs. Bennet is just so wrapped up in like, they have to get married. They have to get married. They have to get married. You know, Mrs. Gardner is kind of like on the outside and I don't know, just probably like Nan said, less judgmental, less like she has less eggs in the basket. I don't know. Is that the word? Like, what's funny is Mrs. Bennet is telling her all the news, which of course she already knows because Jane and Elizabeth have already told her everything because they go and visit her often and they've spilled it all. So later when they're talking in private, then Elizabeth and Mrs. Gardner talk about Jane's situation. And Elizabeth says that Jane was in love and that Bingley leaving was no accident. It didn't just happen. Like it was, I guess maybe it was orchestrated, right? Mrs. Gardner suggests that Jane come and stay with them in London to help her recover, even though that's where he is. She thinks it's unlikely that they might run into each other, but I think Elizabeth secretly hopes that that might happen. They might run into each other while she's there. And she also cautions Elizabeth to be careful about getting involved with Wickham, especially since neither of them have very much money, which I think they go into that a little bit in the next chapter too. But
yes.
And then I just love that the Gardners are like more involved, more level-headed, more grounded adults than Mr. and Mrs. Bennet. They're just more there for the girls. So.
Well, and I love too that they talk about the fashion, like they count on her coming from London. And then the moms, Your coming just at this time is the greatest of comforts. I'm very glad to hear what you have to tell us of long sleeves. So is the fashion news that we're getting from London is just as important as you bringing comfort and coming for Christmas. Like, what's happening with the sleeves, right? I think women talk. I think that you can have a conversation with a woman and 1 minute it's like shallow and like, oh, wow, your dress is fantastic. Where did you get that? Or your hair looks so good. And the next minute you're crying over some really serious thing, right? And it's all good. The other one, and I did kind of have a question about this too. And Laura, you mentioned like they'd been to visit her, but we also have heard in other places that their dad hates London and their mom would like to go more often, but they don't really go. We don't have the impression that they've had an official come out season in London. That coming out was probably done in their own village. But it does say at the end of the second paragraph in 25 that they had frequently been staying with her in town. So there is some indication that at least the girls have had some holidays to stay in London, even if they've never done like a full season, because later on we'll find out the Garners don't really go out very much. They have little kids, they don't have tons of money. Her husband's a successful merchant, but they're not really, they maybe haven't quite broken into that aristocratic class yet. Even when they're in London, they aren't really like on the scene, maybe quite as much. They mostly spend time with their aunt and uncle and their children.
That's something that I was thinking about too, because it kept saying, well, they don't go to London, but they do just as a family, they don't, and they haven't done the whole coming out thing. You know, they frequently talk about how Mr. and Mrs. Gardiner live in Cheapside on Gracechurch Street. And that's very much looked down upon by Miss Bingley, Mrs. Hurst, really Darcy too.
It's what they would say. It was not a fashionable address.
Exactly. And so it also makes me wonder if it's pretty far away from the hub. And so it's London, but it's not like London.
London's enormous. And if all you've got is a carriage, you know, if you're not right in the neighborhood.
I mean, I guess we could probably bust out an old map or something and find out exactly where Cheapside was, Gracechurch Street. But I don't know.
And Wickham works very hard to charm Mrs. Gardiner.
Yes, they make a connection over Pemberley because we find out that Mrs. Gardiner did grow up in Derbyshire. So she does like him, but she can see that he is kind of artful. And I don't think she likes that very much. Okay, so 26 and 27, Mrs. Gardiner does warn Lizzie against Wickham because she's somebody they like make this connection, but she's not somebody who's drawn in by people that way. She's very mature. And so she does caution Lizzie. And the way she goes about it apparently is in such a way that Lizzie doesn't take offense, as most young people are pretty adverse to any sort of advice or caution. She comes right out and she says, "You are too sensible a girl, Lizzie, to fall in love merely because you are warned against it." So she's like, "I'm saying this knowing that my saying it is not going to make you immediately go for him.
You're not going to be rebellious and just go right after him telling you not to." Yeah.
Right. So basically, I'm just giving you this word of caution. She says, "Seriously, I would have you be on your guard. Do not involve yourself or endeavor to involve him in an affection which the want of fortune would make so very imprudent." She says, "He's a most interesting young man. And if he had the fortune he ought to have, I should think you could not do better. But as it is, you must not let your fancy run away with you. You have sense, and we all expect you to use it. Your father would depend on your resolution and good conduct, I am sure. You must not disappoint your father." And in some ways, it's a little bit off-putting. And I think that Lizzie, she does kind of joke, like she totally takes it in stride and she kind of jokes around with it a little bit. She's like, well, first of all, she's like, "He won't be in love with me if I can prevent it. I should be very sorry to be the means of making any of you unhappy." It's just a lot of pressure. But it was very much the times and what was expected. But man, who you choose in marriage will determine the happiness of your parents. Good grief, you know?
Well, and we'll even determine not just their happiness, but whether or not they'll have enough money in case they live into old age. Like whether or not your sisters are going to be able to keep eating.
Yeah. And so it is sensible caution. It is. Again, I do think it's kind of funny the way that Lizzie, she's like, well, a lot of times when young people fall in love, they totally throw fortune and sense out the window. How do you expect me to be different from all my fellow creatures, you know? And yet she is. She's very wise. And she's like, what I will say is that I won't hurry about anything. So Charlotte and Mr. Collins finally wed. And Charlotte asks Lizzie to both write to her and come visit her in March. And this is like January. And Lizzie is like, "I didn't really want to go and visit you, but okay." In the meantime, so Jane is in London with the Gardeners, and she writes from London and reveals that she has seen Caroline and Mrs. Hurst, but she had kind of just like stopped in to see them and they were on their way somewhere. They really weren't very warm and friendly. They've never invited her back. You know, they were going to be dining with Miss Darcy. They never invited Jane to anything. They acted very kind of aloof. It was many weeks. And then Caroline did come and visit Jane, but she'd never written to her at all. And it was very clear that she didn't want to be there. So it's like Jane finally does have to come face to face with the fact that Caroline really doesn't like her. She's just confused because she's like, why did she even act like she liked me when they were there at Netherfield? That doesn't even compute. She's very confused about that. And Lizzie is like, okay, I'm pretty sure everything between Jane and Bingley is now over. She's like, I know that Bingley liked her. I do. But pretty sure it's all over, especially because Caroline is never going to tell Bingley that Jane is there. So unless they accidentally bump into each other, he's never going to know that she's there. And
Miss Bingley did drop a hint to Jane that her brother knew she was in town and hadn't done anything about it. And we'll find out later on whether or not that's actually true, because she only heard that from Caroline. But
she really was trying to push her away.
He knows I'm here and he just isn't coming.
Yeah.
That's what Jane's kind of terrified about.
Exactly. Yes. At this point, it's questionable whether or not he knew Jane was there. But the whole thing really does bring into question, what kind of man is Bingley anyway? Not really an alpha male. Sorry. Like, he's not. He's kind of a beta. Like, he's very easily swayed. And in everything he does, he's like, oh, there's a house. I want to rent it. Let's do it today. You know, oh, you guys want to stay in London? Okay, let's do that. Oh, I like Jane, but you guys think that we should stay in London? Okay. And everyone's like, oh, he's so agreeable. He's so nice. That is good to a point, but like, be decisive, know what you want, and then go for it. Like, come on, dude. It's not impressive.
That's why he's not the main character.
Yeah, true.
It also, too, another thing, just thinking of like social mores at the time, too, because some of this is like, it's this old misunderstanding trope. Like, why don't Jane and Bingley just communicate? But yeah, at this time period, it would have been wildly inappropriate for him to write to her without an engagement. If they were engaged, he could write to her. But because they're not, they don't. And that's a big thing. That comes up as a big thing in Sense and Sensibility, is with the two sisters in that story. And for a long time, the older sister is convinced that her younger sister is engaged to this man that she's wildly in love with, because they keep writing letters to one another, which they should not be doing if they aren't engaged.
Right.
So that's the other thing, is even if Bingley wanted to reach out to Jane, he can only do it through the intermediary of his sisters, who clearly have a different agenda.
Although we find out later, just in the way that there's interaction between other parties, he could have done something.
He'd been more decisive, for sure.
He could have found a way. Anyway, we also find out, like, kind of a lot happens very quickly. So, like I said, so Charlotte and Mr. Collins are married and leave. Jane finds out that, you know, Caroline is actually a total brat. And also, Lizzie's feelings towards Wickham have completely cooled. She realizes she doesn't really like him at all. And he's turned all of his attentions towards a girl who's just inherited a large sum of money. A tale as old as time. March comes along and Lizzie and Sir William Lucas, and it's Mariah, I believe, is how it looks like Maria, but all
it's Mariah.
It's Mariah. Yeah. And Mariah, they set out for Huntsford to visit the Collinses. They do stop briefly in London to visit the Gardeners and Jane. So Lizzie and Mrs. Gardner have quite this long conversation about Wickham and Miss King, and just a, you know, Mrs. Gardner's sort of perspective on what kind of people these are. Like, he must be mercenary, she must be senseless, just back and forth. There are a few great one-liners at the end of this, though. Lizzie says, stupid men are the only ones worth knowing after all, because she's like, I'm about to go to Huntsford to mingle with like one of the most senseless stupid men there is, and it's going to be just fine. And basically, she's going to get some good laughs out of it. Stupid men are the only ones worth knowing after all. I do not agree with that, but that's just kind of where she's at right now. She's just like, ah, heck with all men, you know? Her aunt invites her to join them for like a summer holiday. They're going to go explore the lake country. And Lizzie is super excited about that. And she says, "What are young men to rocks and mountains?"
It should be on every t-shirt ever.
It should.
I'm sure there's a, you could buy a t-shirt that said that. But
I'm
yeah.
sure. Or oh, we should just design
line.
It.
I we need it. A line of t-shirts.
We actually do. From all the books, like find some of the best one-liners in the books and just create t-shirts out of it. Out of the best books.
It's exactly. A line of t-shirts called Out of the Best Books.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
But I just love that, like, Elizabeth is totally judging Charlotte for marrying for money, but then she totally dismisses yes. The fact that Wickham is doing it.
Well, and again, it's this idea that once she has a view of the world, Elizabeth, this is where her prejudice comes into play. She does get a little bit intractable in viewing things differently. She decided that Collins was an idiot and anybody who married him was crazy, no matter what their motive. And she's decided that Wickham is charming and he can't help the fact that he's a poor young man because the, what does she say? The plain young men must have something to live on as well as
the handsome ones.
Handsome young men must
handsome,
have
something to live on
as well as the plain. The other one liner I love in this section, you just had Amity, was the line from Jane where yes, Jane's realizing Caroline was a brat, but this is the way Jane says it because she's so Jane. If I were not afraid of judging harshly, I should be almost tempted to say that there is a strong appearance of duplicity in all yes. of
this. I don't want to that be is Jane. The meanest that she can not be.
Very nice.
Good grief. Just say it, Jane. Just say it. And I think that's what Lizzie is like trying to do. Jane, just say it. She's awful, you know?
Yeah. Another good line too is take care, Lizzie. That speech savors strongly of disappointment because Lizzie has been getting a little bit snarkier than usual lately. Mm-hmm. And Miss Barner kind of calls her out on that. And I think that's part of the reason they propose this trip to look forward to the Lake Country. And I do feel like kind of a lot happens in a short amount of time in those chapters that Amity yeah. just covered. But I think it's because, and this is like from a writer's standpoint, Austin really needs to push the narrative forward to where her main characters get together again. Right? Because what people are really wanting to read now is more about Lizzie and Darcy, like what's happening there. And until she puts them in proximity to each other, nothing can happen. And it's not necessarily filler. It's good stuff, but she needs a lot of time to pass pretty quickly. We had 5 chapters on their visit to Netherfield when Jane was sick. And now like several months go by, just a few chapters. The other thing to realize through this section is that when Jane and Lizzie are communicating, it's all through letters. They go for about 3 or 4 months without seeing each other. When people visit, they visit for a long time. Charlotte has only moved 50 miles away, but when Lizzie goes to stay, she stays for a month. 50 miles is expensive and it's like a huge trip. It's like traveling yeah. across the country. So you're going to stay
like half a day.
Yeah, that's what Darcy says, is it's half a day. And they did take a little bit longer time because they stopped in London and things. But
and I think he said it was a half a day on good road with a good horse.
Right.
And that would be like a single man on a horse and a rider. But if you've got a carriage and luggage,
it takes longer. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not getting that far. So anyway, yeah. So now Lizzie does at least, though, have something to look forward to. So even though it's this trip, you know, even when it's a trip you might be dreading a little bit, it's kind of sometimes nice just to have a change in your routine. And she has realized that she's kind of missing Charlotte and would like to see just how Charlotte's doing. What she realizes is that when she gets to the house is that Charlotte is actually in her way. She's really happy. She enjoys being able to like maintain her own household and she enjoys like being in charge of things. And, you know, all women in this kind of day and age, they were all raised to be able to have domestic skills that would allow them to run a household one day. So if that dream is not realized, Charlotte has very little to do with her energy or her talent. You know, for a lot of like genteel women, becoming a governess was about the only thing that could happen for them. If they didn't, as far as a job goes, that was about their only recourse. And so Charlotte, you know, didn't have any outlet for all these great housekeeping talents she had until she had a home of her own. But there's a lot of little bits in here that make us realize that Charlotte is not unaware of the fact that she's married to an idiot. I mean, there's just like kind of no way around it, but she's found ways to manage. And I think what's really illustrative here is that women do find ways to manage. You don't always end up in the best circumstance, even if you marry somebody you're really, really in love with. Once you settle into housekeeping and get married, you realize you come from 2 very different family cultures and those things have to be reconciled and balanced. And so that's what Charlotte's doing. She's finding ways. She encourages her husband to be out in the garden a lot, which he enjoys. That's great for him, but it means he's not in the house bothering her. She's chosen a sitting room in her house, which is not in the ideal spot. But because the room itself isn't that great of a room, it means it's less likely that Mr. Collins is going to drop in on them often to visit or bother them. And Elizabeth realizes as she settles into the routine of their lives that Charlotte is actually not having to spend tons of time with her husband. She's also realizing through things that Charlotte is saying very carefully. Charlotte should be a diplomat. She's so careful in the way she speaks. That Lady Catherine de Bourgh is heavily involved in their lives and gives advice on everything. And once we meet Lady Catherine, we realize that what her awfulness really stems from is she thinks she always knows best. And she will always tell you exactly what she thinks. And she rarely thinks that whatever you're doing is correct. That she has a better way to do it and she will tell you. And this has happened with Charlotte's housekeeping. Charlotte says about Lady Catherine, "Lady Catherine is a very respectable, sensible woman indeed," added Charlotte, "and a most attentive neighbor." And kind of just like leaves it at that. And we see soon, but what she really means is she's a nosy busybody that can't keep out of my housekeeping. Like, she's here all the time bugging me about how to do things. There are a few lines that they wrote into the BBC version from the 90s that don't appear in the books, but they are excellent lines. As Charlotte's showing her around the house, she points to a closet that they put some shelves in at Lady Catherine de Bourgh's suggestion. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth said, "Shelves in the closet. What a happy idea," right? Or make some comment like this to show, like, "That's a terrible idea. You did it." That line is not in the book. There are a few zingers they get in that are so spot on, show that they were real fans of the book before they wrote some of those lines. Then Elizabeth finally sees Miss de Bourgh for the first time. So this is Lady Catherine's daughter, who the rumor is had that to keep the Darcy fortune in the family, Miss de Bourgh is supposed to be marrying Darcy. I get the impression that this is probably, Catherine de Bourgh is always portrayed as being quite a lot older than Darcy, more like an age of his grandmother versus his mother. And so I don't think she's a first cousin. She could be a first cousin once removed or even a second cousin. Although in that time period, it really wasn't that uncommon for cousins to marry one another. So it seems a little strange that they're fairly closely related, but everybody thinks they're going to make a good match anyway. And when Elizabeth sees her, she's kind of pale and sickly. And Elizabeth's like, "Oh, she looks sickly and cross. She'll do very well for him." So even after all these months away from Darcy, she's still in this place. She's not really over him. In some ways, she's still just like wishing him ill. In a lot of ways, her feelings for Darcy right now are stronger than her feelings for Wickham ever were. They're just strong in the negative. Then they're so excited in chapter 29 because they got a visit up to the big house. And this has been happening fairly regularly. But Mr. Collins feels like it's because there's a new person in town and she just wants to kind of see everybody and be seen. And so they bring up to the house and they have this dinner that is awkward and uncomfortable because we get Lady Catherine de Bourgh's dialogue for the first time. Before they go, Mr. Collins says, "Don't make yourself uneasy, cousin, about your apparel. Lady Catherine is far from requiring that elegance of dress, which becomes herself and her daughter. I advise you merely put on whatever your clothes are superior to the rest. No occasion for anything more. Lady Catherine will not think the worse of you for being simply dressed. She likes to have the distinction of rank preserved. So your clothes are awful. Just choose whatever's best of the awful clothes you have, and Lady Catherine will appreciate it anyway."
She always wants to be better than you anyway, so it's going to be, she's going to pick apart everything, but in the end, she's happy because she will be confirmed in her superiority.
Yes. And we can see too, why when Mr. Collins first proposed to Elizabeth, the very first reason he gave for proposing is that Lady Catherine thought it was time. And once you meet Lady Catherine, you're like, "Oh, okay." Lady Catherine thought it, we better do it. And then they have this kind of delightful exchange at dinner where Elizabeth is so strong. And again, just this idea of like, she's just going to be herself and she doesn't let Lady Catherine intimidate her. And even while Lady Catherine is acting like a total cow and saying some really like awful things to her, Lizzie just like holds her own and she looks her dead in the eye and says things such as when, "Oh, you never had a governess? I've never heard of such a thing. Your mother must have been a slave to your education." "No, not really." Just like, she didn't care too much. And then she talked about all five of her sisters being out at the same time. She says, "How odd. And you only the second, the younger ones out before the elder are married." And then she gives this long speech about how, well, there's not going to be a whole lot of sisterly affection between the sisters if the younger ones have to wait for the older ones who get married, who not only may not have the opportunity, they may also not have the inclination to marry early, as if they would have some choice about it. And truthfully, for being in their, you know, Elizabeth's 20 and Jane's probably close to 22, they are a little bit older for getting married. Then Lady Catherine very rudely asks Elizabeth what her age is. With three younger sisters grown up, replied Elizabeth, smiling, your ladyship can hardly expect me to own it. And then Lady Catherine is so shocked she didn't get a correct answer. You cannot be more than 20, I'm sure. Therefore, you need not conceal your age. And then she finally admits to being not yet 1 and 20. And then all the conversation is very stilted after that. Charlotte's father is just looking for names he can pick up and drop later on. Mariah is too terrified to say anything. All Mr. Cullen can do is effuse about how perfect everything at Rosings is. And Charlotte is just trying to keep the peace and know she has to live there for her entire life. So Lizzie is not very excited to be here and finds out pretty soon that things are going to pick up with some more visitors coming to Rosings. So that takes us to chapter 30.
Something that I did want to point out, and you alluded to it, but just how, you know, they go in and all the visitors are quite intimidated by everything that Mr. Collins has sort of prepared them with. And he did feel like he needed to prepare them so that, you know, they wouldn't be just, you know, pass out from the grandeur of Rosen's Park. But I love how Elizabeth, she's like, what does it say? Elizabeth found herself quite equal to the scene and could observe the three ladies before her composedly, meaning Lady Catherine, Mr. Berg, and Mrs. Jenkinson, or Miss Jenkinson. She really finds no reason to be intimidated by Lady Catherine. And I love that so much. She's just like, this is silly. There is no reason for me to cower before these people. They're not better than me just because they have more money. And I think that it talks about that later is just because there's money doesn't mean there's intelligence or more talent or taste. Yeah, absolutely. And so she like immediately takes that in and acts accordingly.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Could I be like that? Like not care, or I don't know if somebody was that intimidating around me. She's strong. To be like, I don't care what she thinks. That's a hard thing to do.
With this character, this is going to be, there's kind of a climax showdown that comes for these two much later in the book. And without spoiling too much or anything, she basically, you know, says of Darcy, he's a gentleman. I am a gentleman's daughter. Therefore, we're equal. And so it doesn't matter that he has more money or more pride or any of those things. It doesn't matter that Lady Catherine has those things. Elizabeth knows who she is, and she doesn't ever waver from that. Like, really, she's able to change and grow, but her basic personality, she knows she's strong, she knows who she is, and is willing to change when changes are needed, but doesn't change herself to fit into somebody else's mold of accomplishment or whatever.
So we're at chapter 30. Sir William had come to visit, to check on his daughter. They talk about him a little bit in the last couple chapters, is that right? Okay. Like, he was there, right? Anyway, so he feels like, okay, I've seen her situation's okay, so he leaves. And I think what Nan was saying earlier, Elizabeth and Charlotte are spending most of their time in the drawing room so that they can stay away from Mr. Collins. And Lady Catherine, again, she's frequently criticizing everything she sees when she comes in. I love how she criticizes literally everything. The way she plays the piano, the clothes she's wearing, her family situation. It's just incredible.
Crazy rude, right? There's one point where Mr. Darcy hears her talking and he says he looked abashed at his aunt's ill breeding.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just a really rude behavior. Like, I don't care who you are. These are really rude questions. These are really rude statements to be making.
I love being in those situations where you're watching somebody else talk and you're like, don't say that. Oh, why did you say that?
Yeah. At the same time, it does make you go, look, money does not make the man. Money does not make the woman. So again, another reason for Elizabeth to totally not be intimidated by this woman. She has no social skills whatsoever. What makes her better than anybody else?
Yeah.
She inherited money. Neat. You know? And because of that, she feels like she can tell everybody else what to do. No one actually likes her.
And that happens a lot, I think, too. Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Somebody has money, but no friends. I don't know.
Yeah. No character. Yeah.
100%. And I love that Mr. Collins consults her about everything. He has to get her permission for everything. So Lady Catherine has arranged a visit with her nephews, who are Mr. Darcy and then his cousin, Colonel Fitzwilliam. And they
that right there makes me think that Darcy's first name must be a family name. because his cousin's last name is Colonel Fitzwilliam. Fitzwilliam's his last name, but we'll learn later that Darcy's first name is Fitzwilliam. So there must be like a family connection with that name.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing, and this is kind of an interesting side note, and I don't know why she would have picked this name necessarily, but Fitz, the prefix Fitz on a name, usually indicated that it was like an illegitimate child of royalty. So like my mom's family name has been traced back to Henry VIII, but it was Fitzpenn. Mm-hmm. They were given that name after Henry VIII. I mean, it could potentially be that with the surname Fitzwilliam, there could be like a royal connection, but it's from generations before.
Interesting.
That's cool. It's just kind of interesting. I don't know if Austin did that intentionally, but if you see the prefix Fitz, that was done for several hundred years, that it was like illegitimate. So they could differentiate between legitimate heirs and illegitimate ones. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah, I believe that she's invited them and they're staying in another house nearby. So Mr. Collins invites them over for a visit. And when Darcy arrives, he's again like aloof. There's not very much conversation going on. And that's when at the end of that chapter, chapter 30, Elizabeth asks him, "Have you seen Jane in London?" And Darcy seems very uncomfortable with the question. And does he answer her?
He says, "No, I have not had that pleasure."
Okay. But he does, it makes him very uncomfortable. Okay, and then in chapter 31, so Elizabeth and Fitzwilliam seem to be getting along really well. And during the visit, he asks her to play the piano. And that's when there's this whole conversation about musicality and like if she practiced more.
Oh, cute. I love this part.
Do you? Like if she practiced more, she would get better.
Yeah, and she flirts with Darcy, but it's almost like she's able to do it because Colonel Fitzwilliam's there. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like through a third party because Colonel Fitzwilliam is a total sweetheart. Yes. And so she kind of feels like flirtatious with him. So I feel like more of her real personality is coming out here. And then she sort of teases Darcy secondhand through Colonel Fitzwilliam by talking about when they met. And if Darcy wasn't crazy about her before, this one conversation is enough for him to like lose a lot of sleep.
Yeah.
Yes. As we will find out.
They have this conversation about the music. And then she tells him, is this the flirty part you're talking about? She tells him about the first ball where she saw him. And she's like, there were a lot of ladies there that wanted to dance. And he only danced four times. And then he tries to excuse his behavior by saying, "I certainly have not the talent which some people possess of conversing easily with those I have never seen before. I cannot catch their tone of conversation or appear interested in their concerns, as I often see done." And this is the part where we were talking off camera before. This is what made me think, could he be autistic? He is totally not getting social cues or not knowing how to handle social situations. And what I had seen in this video that I watched last night on YouTube on accident that spoiled some of the book for me was that in the Keira Knightley version that he does seem socially awkward, maybe a little bit autistic, but then in the 90s version, the BBC version, he's like angry and a jerk. Does that make sense? I just loved his comments there that
we'll see later on. We'll see Pemberley. He's been raised to be kind of the lord of the manor. And this is really still, I mean, officially the serf system have been outlawed for hundreds of years by the time Darcy rolls around. But these wealthy landowners from these big titled or landed gentry, these families, they would literally like have the livelihoods of hundreds of people within their control by whether or not their lands were profitable. It's not a huge difference from like the lord and the serf kind of like mode that England started in. And I think it's just taking England a long time to like get out of that way of thinking. And so I think in some ways, Darcy is trained to be aloof. He's been trained to be separate from people who are lower than him. So yeah, whether it's by choice or inclination or he's shy or he's got he's neuroatypical, like whatever it is, it's only Elizabeth who sees his aloofness really as a problem. Or a handful of people, right? Like they gossiped about him in the little town. But you know, if Mr. Darcy walked in and started throwing his weight around, they'd get in line too. These class distinctions are still very well preserved up through this time.
That's really true. I think it really probably is that because we see later on He can be extremely gracious and personable, and he's very authoritative and can throw his weight around, like you say, and take control of a situation. Like,
especially at Pemberley, where he's
especially
around,
at Pemberley.
He does already know.
Yes, absolutely. He can do well. I think it may just be that he maybe really doesn't know how to interact well with people who all of his life he's been told they're lower than he is. How does he know that he's supposed to care about what they have to say? You know, which maybe seems very foreign to us, but he's a man of his time. Like, that was never within his purview that he should care about what country folk are doing or saying.
Yeah. So yeah, I just love that line. He's like, I cannot catch their tone or conversation or appear interested in their concerns, as I often see done. So then Elizabeth gives him this analogy that if she practiced the piano more, she might be a decent musician, just like he might practice talking to people. And then I think this is part of his flirt, right? He like kind of smiles at her and he says, we neither of us perform to strangers.
It's the one thing both their characters really have in common. It's a brilliant line, and it's so true for both of these characters.
Yeah. And then Lady Catherine interrupts them and demands to know what they're talking about. And then I love that she says her daughter would have been a great musician if her health had been better. Elizabeth notices that Darcy seems unimpressed and uninterested in Lady Catherine's daughter.
Darcy keeps dropping by for these awkward visits where he just sits and doesn't say much by Charlotte's house. And Charlotte a couple of times is like, Lizzie, he must be in love with you. Why else would he come? And she's like, he just comes and sits and doesn't say anything. And then he goes away. Like, this is the dumbest behavior I've ever seen. But it's like, he doesn't know what to say.
We do this all the time with, like, I do this with my daughter. I'm like, he'll say things about a boy doing something. I'm like, he likes you. If boys don't like you, they don't text you every day, or they don't like come over all the time or whatever. Anyways, that just reminded me of that. Like, he likes you. Why else would he come here and be awkward?
Exactly. I love it.
I think Colonel Fitzwilliam too is another character that, I mean, there's lots of, you know, Austen paints lots of potential love interests for Lizzie throughout this whole book. Colonel Fitzwilliam is one that's sometimes like overlooked. And sometimes in some film versions, he's the same thing. He only gets a couple of lines. He's meant to just be a foil for Darcy or a vehicle for getting some information to Elizabeth or something. And but I think he is a pretty great character himself too. He just is kind of a side character. So he doesn't get as much like airtime in some of the films. So sometimes people are unaware of the fact that Darcy didn't come alone to Hertfordshire, you know, to see his aunt. I think it allows having that extra person there allows Elizabeth and Darcy to talk to one another. And what is great is everybody else they've ever been around is either hostile to Darcy or hostile to Elizabeth. Like when they were at Bingley's house, half the people there don't like Elizabeth. So I feel like in some ways they can't really be themselves because they've got to be on guard against this unsafe person that's there, other people. But Colonel Fitzwilliam really likes them both. And he's kind of delightful to hang out with the three of them, right? And because he likes them both, I think they're both able better to express their own characters because they are not being on guard against people who may disapprove of them.
That's so true. And yeah, I love it. And I love Colonel Fitzwilliam, especially as we learn a little bit more about him in chapters 32 and 33, we find out that he knows Darcy through and through and he still likes him. So, you know, that's very telling, and I think it goes a long way. So
Colonel Fitzwilliam needs his own book.
He does. He need to know more about him.
In a different book.
Yes, absolutely. Because he's one that I'm always like, oh, but Colonel Fitzwilliam, like, he's so great. He's such a good guy. We need to know that he makes a good match and has a good life because he's such a good guy. Anyway. And 32, Lizzie is all by herself in the parsonage and Mr. Darcy just sort of like bursts in and he was thinking that others would be at home because like we've said before, this is fairly inappropriate for him to just like barge in on Lizzie all by herself. But he does. He comes to call and they do have quite an awkward conversation. It ends after Charlotte and Mariah do get home. But in the course of their conversation, they just talk about how, like, first of all, Lizzie is feeling like she has to lead out because he's just like awkwardly sitting there, not really saying anything. she's asking about Bingley and finds out from Darcy that basically they don't really have any plans to go back to Netherfield and he may give it up. You know, I'm pretty sure he was renting it before. So basically Darcy is like, if a better place comes along, I'm sure Bingley will give up Netherfield. They also talk about like Charlotte's distance from her family. And it's almost like Darcy is trying to get a feel for like for Lizzie's idea about what a good distance from family is.
He's dropping hints hard there.
Yes.
And it's so funny because she can't figure out what he's on about, but he keeps talking about, is this a far distance from your family?
Yeah, it's not that far. It's not that far. It's only 50 miles.
Yeah, you wouldn't always want to live by your family, would you?
She's yeah. Like, you wouldn't always want to be by Longbourn. So Lizzie is like trying to figure out what the heck he's doing. Like, why did he even come? And she's finally like, well, he probably just doesn't have anything else to do. Like, he's just probably super bored. But after that, he keeps coming and we don't get any of the conversations, but we find out that he and Colonel Fitzwilliam will come together. They'll come separately. They come very frequently. And it talks about how she really likes Colonel Fitzwilliam. She says that he kind of reminds her of Wickham, just in his like his agreeableness, his charm, his charisma. But she's pretty sure that he is much more, she says, more informed. In other words, more intelligent, more well-read, more educated. And that's something that is very valuable to her. Mrs. Collins, like we've said, she is convinced that Darcy likes Elizabeth, but she's like trying to find like specific evidence and she can't like really find it other than that he's like always around.
And he just stares at Elizabeth a lot.
I know. She's like, he looks at her a lot, but I don't know if he's just staring into space or if he's like really checking her out. Like, I don't know. And she'll bring it up to Lizzie. She's like, I think he likes you. And Lizzie just like laughs it off. Like, it's just completely impossible. She also is like, well, Colonel Fitzwilliam would be a really good match, you know? So she really wants, she wants Lizzie to make a good match. And she's kind of looking for this to happen.
Sensible Charlotte. This is one I love too. And it's kind of in those ones you just talked about. In Charlotte's mind, again, ever practical Charlotte, she believes that her friend's dislike would vanish if Elizabeth could suppose Darcy to be in her power. So this idea that like, well, maybe the reason Elizabeth persists in disliking him is she still thinks that he dislikes her. If she believed otherwise, maybe she would change her mind. So just having been given love, is that enough to make a woman change her mind about being in love, right? So kind of interesting to see how that's eventually going to play out a little bit.
For sure. And I guess that's something that I've been thinking all along is just like, there are all of these signs. All the flags are there. Anybody, but she is so determined from that very first encounter that he hates her and that he could never like her, that everything he does is just a sign of like despising her instead of, or trying to mock her instead of what it actually is, that he's trying to get closer to her and he really likes her and he's like flirting with her. And, but she won't see it because of that very, the first impressions, right?
Yeah.
We find out that Lizzie frequently is walking through the woods, Rosings Park, and she has run into Darcy many times. And here's another, I love this so much. It was so funny.
You know, says they're both so dumb. Like, right? I don't know my sticky note. They're both so dumb. Like, right?
They are. I know, but I know. I love it. The very first time they ran into each other, she like purposely tells him, I come this way a lot so that he would not come that way again, so that he would avoid seeing her because she's very sure he doesn't want to see her. And then she's so confused when he come, it, like they run into each other again and again. It's so odd. And he, it's also so odd that he is always like, whenever they run into each other, he like turns and walks home with her. She just can't figure it out.
Okay, I gotta admit though, I would think for Darcy, this has got to be part of the appeal. Elizabeth is doing it completely inadvertently. Yes. But between Darcy's money and his looks and his height and his land and all the things, you have to know that when Darcy's been in London during the season, women just throw themselves at him, or their mothers throw their daughters at him, right?
Yeah.
He's probably been headhunted for years as being like the most eligible one of the most eligible. And so this idea that this woman is completely indifferent, he's not charming, but the idea that this woman is somehow completely indifferent to his whole presence, she doesn't want to dance with him, she doesn't like give him the time of day, but she seems to be funny and charming with other people, like that's got to be part of the appeal, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. It's very enticing, right? Like there is a lot of mystery. Men like a puzzle, right? Like at least decent men. Out on one of her walks, she actually runs into Colonel Fitzwilliam instead and finds out that he and Darcy will be leaving Kent the following Sunday if Darcy doesn't put it off again. So she finds out that Darcy keeps putting off their leaving. Another big sign, like, come on. And this is where in the course of their conversation, she kind of is like, I think he might have a thing for me, because just some of the things that he says, he basically is like, you know, as a younger son, I can't necessarily marry for love. I have to look for money. So she kind of thinks, well, that's his way of telling me that he likes me, but he can't do anything about it, which is probably true. And she's a little bit, you know,
has a job. I'm like, how much money is enough money? This is like the one guy we talked to actually has employment. I guess Wickham does too, but we're about to find out about his gambling debts. So
Right.
He is Sergeant Troy.
He totally is. She also finds out that he is co-guardians with Darcy of Miss Darcy. And so that tells you, like, he's a really good guy. He's very trustworthy. He knows Mr. Darcy very, very well, so much so that he is also a guardian of his younger sister. So Lizzie is like, well, she kind of hints that maybe Miss Darcy might be some trouble for them because she's probably used to always getting her way, like Mr. Darcy. And he's like, just the way he reacts, she's like, maybe I hit on the truth. This is such a subtle foreshadowing, but it really is foreshadowing. It's very, very brilliant, I think, the way that she writes right there.
William is basically like, why? What have you heard?
Yeah. But it leads to a very troubling line of conversation where we find out, without any names being mentioned, because Colonel Fitzwilliam doesn't actually know the names, but Darcy has been basically patting himself on the back for the breakup of Bingley and Jane. And he takes credit for persuading Bingley that he should not marry Jane because it would be an imprudent match. Of course, like I said, Fitzwilliam doesn't know Jane and doesn't know that Jane has any connection to Lizzie. And he doesn't even know the names of the people. He just knows that, you know, one of Darcy's good friends, Darcy has like taken him away from this girl because it would have been a very bad match. Lizzie is super disturbed, very angry about this because she knows that it's Bingley and Jane. And she's very sure that the only reason Darcy objected to their match was because of the Bennets' poor connections. She's sure that's the only reason. She's just really distraught by this, and so much so that she basically gets herself sick and has to excuse herself from going to Rosings Park that night. And that is where we end. And it's the setup for the next chapter, which is going to be so good. So exciting.
Well, and I think what's so important about this too is up until now, like, Elizabeth's been annoyed at Darcy. She's been irritated with him. She knows he has like some undue influence over Bingley, but I don't think she's been really angry at him.
Yeah.
And then after she speaks with Colonel Fitzwilliam, she's beyond just like feeling like archly annoyed or kind of, you know, snarky towards him or whatever. Now she's just very angry with him. And this will be her attitude towards Darcy when she sees him next. But up until then, like, her conversation with Colonel Fitzwilliam was pretty like funny and delightful. I love the parts. Younger sons cannot marry where they like, he says to her kind of carefully. And she says, unless where they like women of fortune, which I think they very often do, which is hilarious. And then so to like make him not feel awkward or herself awkward, she keeps teasing him. And pray, what is the usual price of an earl's younger son? Unless the elder brother is very sickly, I suppose you would not ask above 50,000 pounds, you know, kind of indicating they both understand the mercenary nature of the marriage thing that they're into, but they're still going to live within the culture that they have, and they're still going to enjoy each other's company anyway. And that's why her whole sea change in her attitude and everything here is very, very stark. She's very much herself when she starts meeting with Colonel Fitzwilliam.
Right.
And very much not in her normal disposition when she leaves her conversation with him.
Wow, this is so good.
That is so good. The next part is so good.
I could listen to you guys talk about this all day.
Well, I'm just so happy that you're loving it, because I know, like, in the past, sometimes we've suggested Austin for book group. It's the one, my one book group pick that consistently gets voted down is anything Austin that I try to suggest. And I know our friend Eve used to just always say, I don't know, it's the old timey language. I just can't do it. She called it the old timey language or the old fashioned language. And I get it. I know that it's hard, but it's just so worth it.
Well, it's so much easier than like A Tale of Two Cities. I felt like after we finished that, I'm like, I can read anything now.
Yes. I was kind of distraught the other day because, and I shouldn't have even been, because I don't even know the people, but I'm a part of several Facebook groups of, a lot of them are like homeschooling moms, and it's like, not just local, it's like countrywide, some around the world, whatever. So one lady was like wanting suggestions for good books for her book group. And she was like, I don't want anything by Jane Austen. I don't want Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, or any of these. She's like, but I do want like the classics. Classics are good. And all I want are female authors. And I was like, and yet you just ruled out like some of the best ones. What are you even talking about? But she didn't want anything by Jane Austen. And some people even like tried to say, what about Jane Eyre? She's like, I said, I don't want Jane Eyre. Like, I don't like that book at all. And I was like, how could you just say like you don't like Jane Eyre and that you don't like Jane Austen books?
Really hefty conversations in Jane Eyre about, I mean, there's some good conversations to be had there. I'm not saying that that's a perfect hero and heroine, but that's part of the
no, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's why I'm like, are they perfect people? Is it a perfect situation? Is it something that we want to take and live exactly that way? No, but it is. It's all about the conversation. It's all about what we can learn from it. It's all about the joy of the prose and the and learning about life. And I don't know. It makes me sad. When
the long-term popularity of a book like Pride and Prejudice, right? It's like over 200 years since it's been published. And we're able to still find all of these relevant things and see these women conversing in a way. It's not like reading a modern Regency novel where somebody looked back at that time and then they're writing about it. But mm-hmm. to read in Austen's words, what people of that time were thinking, how women really were of that time.
Yes.
People just like huge sisterhood, like women are the same, like we've been the same. And it makes me think of my own ancestors that may have been alive at that time. Like we mm-hmm. have conversations about these things. There's social things that change, but we still have mores and things that like get under your skin, and we're going to talk everything to death, and we're going to analyze it and figure it out. And I love the story of these five sisters doing that for one another. It's just so funny. There's one funny moment in the Keira Knightley version that I just think is so classic. It's the five sisters just in their natural habitat. They've been like crafting, they've been trimming bonnets. One of them's like laying on the couch with like some of her stays kind of undone, right? That's right. Like being sisters. And then they find out that one of the guys is coming, and they have like 2 minutes to
panic
and look ready and like pinch your cheeks and like look ready for these men to show up at the house, and they're stuffing everything away. And I'm like, that is real life right there. I don't yes. know what century you're in. That is what life looks like.
Yes, I love it.
Yeah, so next week we'll cover chapters 34 to 42. We're going to get smart here and look it up, because I was editing like the episode before our first episode, and I said we were going to do chapters 1 through 10, and it was like actually 1 through 13. Like, oops. I'm like, I'm going to look from now on.
I've been so excited to recommend my book all week.
Oh, good.
Yay! I read it actually last week. I pounded through it. It's called Finley Donovan is Killing It. And it's about a woman. Have you heard of it, Amity? You nodded.
No, I haven't. But I just love that title so much.
So it's about a woman who's a single mom and has like the tropes, right? Like the deadbeat ex-husband and everything. But she's very... I just love her. And it's really well written. I just feel like there's a funny absurdity to the book, but there's also a lot of pathos of these being like real people. And she happens to be a murder mystery novelist, kind of a low time publishing, doesn't like get a lot of hits, but this is kind of what she does for a living. And she's meeting with her agent in a Panera one day. And there's somebody in the Panera who overhears the conversation. And it honestly sounds like this woman's a serial killer. Like she's a hitman, a hit woman. And this lady in the Panera slips her card because she wants her to kill her husband and offers her a lot of money to do it. And she's desperate for money. She has no intention of killing anybody, of course. She's like a great person. But she is a little curious about what could make this woman hate her husband bad enough. And she's kind of looking for an idea for a book. So she follows the guy. She knows where he's going to be, and she follows him one night, leading to a series of like unfortunate events that are so absurd and funny and just charming. And there was no language in the book. There's not, I mean, there's like some kissing, but it's not like, it was pretty clean for the nature of what the book is and the type mm-hmm. of writing it is. But I was just enchanted, and it was hilarious. I laughed like out loud a few different times at the absurdity. And it's for anybody, if you ever had a friend that was so close that you're like, yeah, I'd bury a body for you. If you ever had a friend like that, because there's these, because she has a best friend that's like her kid's nanny, and oh my gosh, delightful. They're just so absurd. It's kind of murder mystery, but it's not like macabre. They're not like grisly or, but it's just like how this single mom ends up like tangling with the Russian mob on accident. It's so funny.
Oh my gosh. I want to listen to it or read it or whatever.
That actually, the listen so to was great because the author does like the Russian mobster voices. So there's nice. Like the, and her best friend is Hispanic, and she pulls off that accent too really, really well. And it was awesome. Delightful.
So mine's very similar. I'm so excited. It's called The Mostly True Story of Tanner and Louise. I loved this book. I've had like 3 books in a row that I just loved, which is great because I had had several that weren't so great lately. So this young girl is a soccer player, and she has this massive scholarship at this college, and she gets hurt and can no longer play soccer. And so she doesn't know what she's going to do with her life. So she gets hired to be a driver for this elderly lady. The elderly lady is mean, was not very nice, and they don't get along very well. And she's like kind of the caregiver, but just really hired to be the driver and live with her. And she has these like certain places she goes every day, right? She goes and plays cards and she goes whatever. So one day she's watching the news. Somebody that is like, they're looking for in a cold case from like the 40s. Where there was this huge jewelry heist, and they have like an age progression picture, and it's totally the lady. They basically run both. So she runs with this old lady, and it is the funniest thing I've, it's kind of like, I think it's a playoff of like, what's that store, the show with Louise in it.
Thelma and Louise.
Yes. It's mm-hmm. like a playoff of that. It was so cute. I loved it. It was delightful. Like, I laughed out loud a couple of times. I don't do that very often in books. Anyways, it's The Mostly True Story of Tanner and Louise by Colleen Oakley. So good. So good.
How fun.
I loved it.
You guys had some really good ones.
He's going to give us something heavy now. Laura and I are like, it's light for summer.
Well, so I feel like everybody else has already read this, but I finally was able to listen to Where the Crawdads Sing. And I was like so shocked, but I was like, you know, I'm just going to put it on hold so that I can eventually listen to it. And I actually went to Libby and there was no waiting list. Like there was no wait at all. I was like, I don't even know what's happening right. There was like, well, maybe everybody's just done with it now, but works for me. So that was one that I pounded through in a couple of days. It was really, really good.
I love it for the science.
Oh my gosh. I loved it too. It was just beautiful. So inspiring that way. I was like, can we all just go out into nature and just watch bugs and like birds and observe seashells? Yeah. I loved that. Of course, I had to just go to YouTube and like watch a couple of clips so I could see who they had, you know, chosen for the parts of Kaya and Tate and
brilliant. Chase. That, yeah. I don't even know who she is. That young actress is brilliant as
well. Yeah, I didn't recognize any of them. She's not quite the way that I had pictured her. It talked in the book about how she's just like gorgeous and stunning and all these things. I thought she was cute. She didn't like really strike me as like gorgeous, stunning. But she's also supposed to be quite timid and obviously very socially awkward and
natural, just not made up or anything.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. But just like a natural beauty. Anyway, that one, I don't think that I laughed at all because we're able to laugh at your books, but I did cry a lot. And especially when she's a little girl and she's just abandoned, there were so, I mean, and Delia Owens just does such an amazing job of like tearing, just ripping your heart up. Like, just picture this sweet little girl. And I just couldn't help picturing like my little Audrey, who's just like so She's such a skinny thing. She's like so little. And I can just imagine her like running around the marshes or something. It does. It just rips my heart out. Like, how, as a mom, could you abandon your baby and never go back? But, and she, you know, she tries to tell the story of the mom, not really give her an excuse, but some reasons, I guess, why she didn't go back. But it's just, it's so sad. And the fact that everybody in the town just deserted her and paid no attention to her. And so any books like that about little children that, I don't know, it's hard for me. At the very end, when they come out with the verdict, because of course she is accused of murder and goes through this whole court case, which also is very intense. Like the way she goes into the description and everything, you're like, oh, that's good. That's good. I've got hope. And then, oh, that's bad. That's going to be really bad. Like she takes you through all the emotions anyway. But when they come out with the verdict, I like broke down and cried. I was like, oh my gosh. Anyway.
And then you get to that last five pages and you go.
I know. Absolutely. So yeah, it was wild. But
then also like, good job. Oh, wait, I shouldn't feel so excited about that outcome. But I know. He was awful.
He was awful.
And in the absence of like a regular societal morality, because she had never been taught one, her understanding of biology is what guided her actions.
Absolutely. I know.
You understand why she did what she did.
Yeah, you totally do.
Standpoint, her actions make perfect sense.
They absolutely do. And that is what raised her, right? It's like everybody else neglected her, but nature never did. And that's what trained her. So
we all three had great books this week. That's great. This must be summer. I don't know. We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss Pride and Prejudice chapters 34 through 42. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.